Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are still broadcasting from Washington, D.C., and we are in the Bulwark studio with the publisher of the Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, and one of our most prominent contributors, Tim Miller.
I'm so happy to be with you guys in person. I have the willies to be in Washington, but I do feel like I'm in a safe space here at the Bulwark HQ.
Safe spaces, that's what we strive for.
It does feel kind of swampy here, though. But, I mean, here we're sitting here. You know, I've been thinking about the state of conservatism because we have all of these conferences on the state of conservatism coming up. And you just think about the moment we're at right now where CPAC is putting on its clown show. And there was a time, though, when guys like us would have been at CPAC, and you know that we would never show up there now. Now it's all Charlie Kirk, let's boo Mitt Romney and Diamond and Silk and dramatic readings of FBI text messages. And so we're going to be over at this summit on principled conservatism, whatever that means. I was restraining myself from saying that on Saturday. And so you do have this moment of like, where are conservatives going? You know, is there a principled conservatism? Can you even define what it means to be a conservative right now?
No. Well, I think that's what the conference is about. Yeah. I think it's going to be a bunch of us sitting around trying to answer that question. Don't you?
Yeah. I'm so happy that Heath's doing this. You know,
By the way, Heath Mayo and Evan McMullen are co-sponsoring this.
Right? Yeah, and I just have a general policy. There's so few of us here in the wilderness trying to navigate conservative world without throwing in with Trump that I try not to be critical. So I think it's awesome that Heath's doing it. I am sort of like you guys. You know, I guess I don't want to preview my big talking points for the panel that everybody's paying their $10 to hear. But I'll just give everybody a tease, yeah. which is sort of like, is there a principled conservatism like exist in a world where Bernie and Trump are the options? I think that Heath is really striving for it. But does striving for principled conservatism just leave you in a place of an inability to actually accomplish any of those goals? And so, I think that what the back and forth will be is what does the future look like? Is there a third path? Is there a new path that folks can chart? Because I think that this idea of going back to kind of zombie Reaganism is not really realistic at this stage. It's hard to envision how that would happen.
I'd prefer the zombie Reaganism to what we have now, but sure. But you're right, we're not going back to it.
Yeah, we're not. It's almost like I'm just formulating my thoughts as we sit here. But the idea of principled conservatism can sort of exist intellectually,
right?
But like as an exercise, as it relates to politics, it seems to have almost no role, because for those of us who came up through sort of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, these think tanks in the conservative movement that cultivate young people, and there was a sort of rigorous intellectual side to conservatism.
We thought that's what the conservative movement was.
We thought that's what it was about. It was about limited government and about having sort of a freedom first posture. And in the age of Trump, like everybody who I grew up with as an intellectual in that movement, with the exception of the people who now literally write for the Bulwark and are, around us, they've all just gone to seed with whatever, like they've reconfigured what conservatism means to them to create a sort of new nationalist populism.
It is disorienting.
And I think that what we all here identify with, maybe this sort of new coalition isn't really, I don't see it on the left-right spectrum really per se. I sort of reprioritized, one thing about the Trump era is that, for me what I realized is my opposition to illiberalism and my belief in pluralism were actually more important than my conservatism. That was something I kind of didn't realize I ever had to rank, because all those three things came together. But, and if you look at the panel I'm on, I'm with Amanda Carpenter, who's another Bulwark contributor. She and I were on the opposite side of every primary I ever worked for. Right?
Really?
She came up in the Ted Cruz, kind of social conservative world. I always worked for, kind of the more moderate, rhinos, if you will. And so Amanda and I would butted heads in primaries. And I think now, where we see our commonality, is like I said, in these areas that maybe aren't related so much to the left-right spectrum, but to kind of the fundamental principles that were underlying it.
In liberal democracy. Yeah.
So, Sarah, I think you and I are in the same spot here. We're trying to sort of figure out this dynamic. And, you know, part of it is your analysis, whatever our analysis is of what the hell just happened to the conservative movement. You know, how much of the conservative intellectual rigor turns out to be just a delusion when conservatism was really about attitude, tribal identity, and all of these other things. So, you know, one of the jibes that's thrown at folks like us is that we are irrelevant. And to a certain extent, that's true if you look at it in terms of the politics. The ideas are still valid, but what is their relevance to the political moment? Am I being clear?
I think you are being clear. I mean, I think the question is to the extent that, let's just say, limited government was a guiding principle or fiscal responsibility was a guiding principle of this movement, to the extent that those principles, which I sort of think what Heath is kind of getting at there, to the extent that they are no longer, the Republican Party was always kind of the not so perfect vessel for those ideas, and it often didn't live up to those ideals, but they were still undergirded what the project was of republicanism. And to the extent that the party no longer orients itself around those at all, then I think and actually there's been a couple of pretty decent articles written about this, which is that, you know, I think when the left critiques what the intellectual right was trying to do, they sort of rightly say, like, it has been a failure. Because if the actual manifestation of what all that sort of, you know, Buckley conservatism manifested in was Donald Trump, like, what were we even doing?
Right. No, and I think there's going to be that kind of introspection. I will say this, whatever the future of conservatism is, principal conservative, it is not to become a liberal. And I think that's going to be kind of the elephant in the room, because there are some folks who have reacted to Trumpism by saying, okay, so it is so infected, conservatism, so exposed it, that we're going to be indistinguishable from leftists. And that I don't think is, I mean, that's fine. They can go in that direction, but that's not principled conservatism. And also, see, you know, you were, I don't want to give away what I was going to say.
Give it away.
This is what we get paid for, so we know this is what we do it. I've actually been kind of working on some notes that there's no principled conservative case to vote for Bernie Sanders. You know, this is the moment. Now, by the way, I understand this will sound like maybe that I'm splitting hairs. You can make a case for voting for Bernie Sanders, you know, as a human being or whatever, because you can't stand it. But from a conservative point of view, if we think of ourselves as conservatives, and I think of myself as a conservative, but also as a father, a husband, a Catholic, and all these other things, there's a lot of other reasons I might, you know, but This is, I think, part of the problem. Where do conservatives go, Sarah, if it is Sanders versus Trump?
Yeah.
Because we can't vote for Sanders.
Right. And I think even to Tim's point, though, which I take really well, this idea of, I think I've gone through something similar to this where I found that my locus of orientation became less about, like, what is quote unquote principled conservatism and more about how do you defend sort of the norms and institutions of liberal democracy that have served America so well. So those are rule of law and a general kind of pragmatic approach to policy. And so the problem is that if you've been, like I have, sort of banging on about those things for the last 3 years, and now Bernie Sanders ends up as the alternative choice, I am struggling sort of openly, I guess, with, I hear arguments where people say, well, if Trump is such an emergency, if he's such an existential threat, you have been saying he's an existential, you meaning us,
which
right?
We have been.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I believe it to this day. There's not a second of me or a piece of me that's walking that back. But if rule of law is fundamental to that and your belief in it, well, Bernie Sanders doesn't actually have a ton to offer. I think for a lot of people, they don't realize, like when he talks about retroactively sort of federally prosecuting, drug manufacturers, he's also, and granted, that's because people are like, yeah, okay. So, like, to me, the best case for Bernie Sanders, I'm just going to, sorry to go on, but the best case is the one JVL makes, which is that Trump has had a 4-year head start on a liberal behavior, and that Bernie Sanders would be at a standing start, like starting from scratch. That is the only decent, because it is not a difference.
Oh boy, let me give you the pushback on that one, is that, you know, a lot of these, you know, the socialist activists have had a 100-year head start on all of this. They have a lot more people who have experience in government and in activism, And they might actually be competent as opposed to the incompetence of Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, it is interesting that, you know, I keep hearing Democrats keep saying, don't worry, he won't get anything done. And I keep being like, is that your pitch? Like, that's your pitch for your candidate, is that he can't do the things that he's saying? Because that's a bad pitch.
That is the pitch.
No, I know. Yeah. I know. But I have not, I cannot find the rationalization. I just, like, in my stomach.
Okay.
I had a conservative friend who's out of politics who asked me, you know, my view on this. And I said, well, I think that both of them are illiberal and hostile to the fundamental American values. On top of that, Trump is a bigot, and he is, this wildly erratic and untrustworthy. So, you know, it's kind of F plus versus F minus, I guess. When you look at the political calculation, though, Charlie, I think this is where relevance does come back into play. And I keep going back to this, you know, Nate Cohn article. And now, neither the Bernie crowd nor the Trump crowd seems to have any interest in having us aboard.
They act as if
we only exist here in the Bulwark studio and in the MSNBC green room, and we do exist in those two places. But we also exist in the suburbs of Detroit and Philly and Milwaukee, as you know,
and
Charlie.
Houston
there were 73,000, I think I have that number right, Ron Johnson voters, or Ron Johnson had 73,000 or 74,000 more votes. So
in
probably
Wisconsin.
Actually 100,000 more voters, because Trump had some too. You know, those people matter. Those people are going to decide the next president. And so I think that while, you know, maybe we have irrelevance in the corridors of Washington right now, you know, the voters who think this way are going to be very relevant in November. And so, you know, I think from a political standpoint, this kind of exercise is valuable, because there are going to be a lot of voters who may determine the election who are going through this exact choice, or this exact thinking that we're talking about now, if it's Trump or Bernie, about whether they throw their cards in with a bad choice or just choose not to vote.
Well, and that's part of the problem, is that I think that a Bernie Sanders nomination gives permission to a lot of Republicans to return back home, you know, that would close that gap between Trump, the delta
Johnson.
Between Trump and Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. So we'll report back after this, the summit over the weekend, the anti-CPAC. And by the way, there's another anti-CPAC of the Grapers.
Michelle Malkins.
Yeah, the actual, you know, like screw it, we are white nationalist, racist, everything. So we have the whole spectrum, but it is an interesting line.
Tucker Carlson isn't hostile enough to brown people. We need to have a separate conference that, you know, ratchets up a little bit more.
Stephen Miller
isn't hostile enough.
Is not radical enough. So
that old softy Stephen Miller.
So I'm the moderator of this on this summit of what is principled conservatism. We got Bill Kristol, Mona Charon, Ramesh Panuro, Peter Weiner, and that's pretty good. You, Sarah, are the moderator of Conservatism, the Constitution, and the Rule of Law. And you have a former acting attorney general of the United States, Stuart Gerson, Donald Ayer, former U.S. attorney, deputy attorney general of the United States, Kerry Cordero, Ilya Sol. I mean, this is a pretty good, this is a great lineup.
Yeah, I have no business moderating
why
panel.
Why isn't Rudy or Bernie Carrick on that?
And we have Tim Miller and Rick Wilson. You got to bring your A game with Rick Wilson. Otherwise, you know, Rick's
I'm going to have to play the
over.
Straight man. I'm just going to play the straight man. Unusual position for me.
Yeah.
For a lot of ways.
Well, we don't know. So we'll see what happens there. Okay, we're airing this on Friday. You had the big story in the Bulwark yesterday, Tim Miller, about the Oppo research that could kill Bernie Sanders. And I think that's sort of a subset. I want to get into that particular story, but the subset of how much Oppo research there is out there against Bernie Sanders, and I just don't get the sense the Democrats have any idea what is going to drop on him after the convention. And you give, really, it's almost like a little hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah, it's just a little taste. You know, this issue that I wrote about, if folks didn't read it, was about Sierra Blanca, which the Clinton campaign kind of mentioned and leaked to a couple liberal reporters, like HuffPost wrote about this in 2016, but there was no campaign on it. There were no ads. There wasn't big discussion. Jake Tapper did, to give him credit, ask the Sanders campaign about this. That was the only mainstream coverage about it in 2016. There's been none this time. And the short story is basically that there was a Texas-Vermont compact. Sanders, where they were going to move the nuclear waste that from Vermont to New Hampshire down to Texas. They selected this very poor border town, Sierra Blanca, which is only known for its border checkpoint that got Willie Nelson arrested. A little fun fact about Sierra Blanca. Basically, all of the liberals in the Senate at the time, the liberals in Texas, Paul Wellstone, you know, they were out there saying this is environmental racism. This is outrageous that you would send your waste
from... This is from, an Hispanic community.
Yeah, yeah, from a white community, you know, rich, you know, a state like Vermont to a very poor Hispanic community in Texas. And Bernie Sanders basically told them all to pound sand. And then as an added bonus, Jane Sanders, his wife, ended up getting a contract with the, you know, Interstate Compact as a consultant. So, you know, look, this is just one anecdote, but I use that.
And that's not the only Jane Sanders scandal.
It isn't. And I use this example in the Bulwark that you can just see how easily the Trump campaign will turn this into Uranium One and the super predators. I mean, this is what these guys
Except
are
this is
good
more
at.
True.
Yeah, it's true, right? Yeah, it has the benefit of being true. One, and two, you don't have to be a strategic genius to see how they'll use it, which is to tamp down vote in the Latino community. Say, you know, Sanders talks a big game, but he used to be a border hawk too, and he dumped nuclear waste and got paid for it, and they will use that on Facebook and probably in Spanish language media to tamp down the Sanders vote. And this is an area where Sanders is vulnerable because his pitch to the Democrats is that he's not the Hillary, right? He's pure. You know, he doesn't have these issues, and so Trump isn't going to be able to so easily turn him into a swamp creature when that's not really the case. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. And you know, the broader context around all this, Charlie, is that Bernie has not faced a sustained attack from the right, center, anywhere. The only attacks he's taken on, besides
this is a crucial point, the debate three days ago, yeah,
was the Hillary campaign and a couple of campaigns this time dabbling and hitting him from the left, saying that he wasn't, you know, his NRA rating was high for a while, a little bit on the immigration issue. Those are the only hits he's taken. And let me tell you, in a Democratic primary, voters look at avowed socialist Bernie Sanders, and they're not buying that. Mm-hmm. Like, that is not a compelling attack on Bernie Sanders for the left. It isn't going to work. There is myriad vulnerabilities. You know, we're seeing it now with Castro on a government takeover of the economy, on issues like Sierra Blanca, that he hasn't even taken a tiny, you know, little poke. Forget a punch. Forget the kind of punch that the Trump campaign can deliver. And so, you know, that was the point I wanted to bring up in this article.
And you guys have both worked on political campaigns and ads, and you know how easy these ads are. I mean, you know what the kind of ads you'd run in Pennsylvania against him. You know what kind of ads you'd run in rural Wisconsin. Yeah,
how about the fracking
him.
Ban?
The fracking ban kiss Pennsylvania goodbye. Castro stuff kiss Florida goodbye. In the suburbs of Philadelphia or Milwaukee, talk about the massive tax increases. Has a Democrat ever run for president saying, I'm going to increase federal spending by $60 trillion and raise taxes on everybody? That may not be quote-unquote controversial enough to derail him in a Democratic primary. It sure as hell will play in a general election, though, even against Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's not even playing that great in the Democratic primary. I mean, like, his plurality is still, like, not a huge plurality. I mean, the thing is like, he can get through a brokered convention because they're never going to take it away from him if he gets, you know, if he's marginally ahead. And he can, you know, with what, 35% of the Democratic vote, then have to go into a general against Donald Trump where, after being not the least bit vetted. It is, I think, I'm not entirely unconvinced that, like, Bernie is a Trump plant. Like, this is such a gift.
Well, and
I'm just going to take on my QAnon conspiracies here. I don't really
well,
think
you don't
that,
have
but like,
to
it's
be
ridiculous.
A conspiracy theorist, because you see in South Carolina, Republicans are openly saying we're going to cross over, we're going to vote for Bernie.
Oh, they want him so bad.
You have this pro-Trump super PAC, which ran that incredibly misleading attack on Joe Biden. In fact, it was so bad that Barack Obama, the former president of the United States, says, you know, take that off the air because it is such a complete lie. But the whole point of that is to prop up Bernie Sanders, right? So
yes,
they
want this. And by the way, just a quick rant on that. How could you have lived through 2016 and thought, you know what, I want to take a flyer on the worst possible candidate and put them into the mix in the general election? It's just crazy. Look, I agree with what both of you guys have been saying. They are whistling past the graveyard. The Democrats are whistling past the graveyard on Bernie's electability. He has so many vulnerabilities that haven't been exposed. That said, you know, coronavirus, economy takes a turn. Once you're the major nominee of a party, you have 40% chance of being the president. Why would a free market conservative Republican in South Carolina or in one of these states say, you know what, if Trump loses, I want Bernie to be the alternative. I want to throw Bernie out there. It is immoral. It goes against, I think our fundamental democratic principles. It is just mind-boggling. People who I respect, I saw on Facebook and Twitter who live in South Carolina. I've done a couple campaigns down there, so I have friends down there who are in the party are posting that they're planning on doing this. And I'm messaging saying to them, what are you really want Bernard Sanders to be the president? You want Sanders and Trump to be the two options? Like, get a grip. I feel like everyone has just, their brains have been warped.
Well,
they're into this kind of partisan warfare that nobody just steps back for a second and says, wait a minute, like, Joe Biden wouldn't be that bad. maybe a better bet instead of getting Trump an easier opponent is getting somebody else who isn't going to further tank the country and the fabric of the country.
Well, also, speaking of rants, and this is tough love for some of our good friends, people I really, really like and admire, who the principled conservatives, non-Trumpy, the folks who very early on gave the Democrats a blank check and said, hey, just so you know, whoever you nominate, I'm going to be okay with. We're going to vote for. I just think that was strategically a mistake or tactically a mistake, because what they should have said is, you know, we hope that you give us don't expect that people like us will vote for you if you lose your mind as well. Maybe there will come a time when certain people, we all know their names, are going to vote that way. But prematurely giving it up,
Sure, or even just saying personally, I respect that. If you're saying that Donald Trump's character is so low that I would vote for a ham sandwich over him, like, fine. Okay, that's fine.
But they meant a ham sandwich, not the shit burger we're getting.
But when you're doing that, pointing out, like you're saying, Charlie, is, by the way, but not everybody's me out there. There are a lot of other voters out there that when you're thinking about what you're doing in this election, don't be deciding on what Tim Miller is going to do. Like, think about what the actual, Republican swing voters are going
to
do.
And let me tell you, a lot of it does have to do with the economy, because I've been, sitting behind the glass in these focus groups talking to these sort of reluctant Trump voters or people who went third party last time, trying to understand what they think is persuasive, where their heads are, what they're thinking. And here's the deal. A lot of them would vote for Joe Biden. A lot of them would vote for Amy Klobuchar. A lot of them would vote for Pete. A lot of them would vote for Bloomberg, although I don't know if they'd still vote for him at this point. I don't know.
I'm pretty close to never Bloomberg myself, we'll get there.
And even with the college-educated women, there's like a rough, not a great, but a rough play for Elizabeth Warren. But Sanders is just a non-starter. And if the economy is doing well, people will be like, yeah, the guy's the worst, but I just looked at my 401k and like it outpaced, it grew 24% or whatever. They're going to think about their kids.
And the inverse of that is true too, by the way. If the, crossover Operation Chaos folks help push Bernie across the line and the economy tanks, maybe some of these people will say, well, it's better to throw in with this guy, and then we're stuck with him.
Going back to your point, Tim, which I think is important, is it doesn't really matter what guys like us, the talking heads do. Whatever I said,
You're in Wisconsin.
No, but I couldn't go to a group of these swing voters and make a case to them, tell them, yes, vote for somebody who is in favor of everything that violates your values. I mean, we could just run this whole thing. The Green New Deal. Free college education. Free K-12A. All of the not pre kindergarten. Right. There's so much free stuff I can't even.
Pre-kindergarten.
Anyway, it's There's no way those voters who don't live in the world that we live in, we have been marinating in the insanity and the erratic nature of Donald Trump. A lot of them have just sort of, you know, figured that's part of the universe out there. But I'm not going to destroy my 401k, my business. I will tell you, there's a new study out in Wisconsin that's going to be weaponized that will say that just the Green New Deal will cost every single family in Wisconsin $40,000. It will kill this many jobs. And once that, and when I say weaponized, I mean when you have, you know, tens of millions of dollars of ads saying this will cost your family, this will cost you your future, your job will disappear, people are going to swallow an awful lot of Trump.
And what I always get the pushback, every interview I do, I'm sure you get this too, Charlie, like the pushback is, well, but you guys were so wrong about Trump last time. You thought he had a lot of oppo against him, and he won. And I'm like, well, sure, right. You're right. But we cannot completely end all logical thought and all, you know, and remove probabilities and remove the lessons that we've learned from every other campaign just because there was one crazy campaign where Donald Trump lost by 2 million votes in the popular vote and squeaked by in three states by 70,000 votes. So yeah, we were wrong about that. It was unexpected. But just because one unexpected thing happens doesn't mean that you now throw out all, you know, logic and consideration future. We never know anymore. Who knows? Maybe the Jill Stein will win this time. How could you possibly predict? Maybe there'll be a fifth party candidate that will win. There are certain lessons that you can still take while still acknowledging that you were wrong about Donald Trump.
We have not repealed the laws of gravity. Right. Okay, so you said something before. You're like never Bloomberg. I mean, what? Hey. I'm close to never Bloomberg.
I'm not never Bloomberg. I will vote for him.
I am never Bernie, but if it came down to Bloomberg versus Trump, he would annoy the hell out of me for 4 years, but
I'd be for Bloomberg. Fine. But at this point, Charlie,
why? His
campaign is so presumptuous and so condescending at this point, and so untethered from the seriousness of the threats that we face. I mean, Michael Bloomberg has spent $38 million of his own money alone on one ad where he pretends like Barack Obama endorsed him. Okay? He spent $0. Zero. That's in our ears. I'm yelling right now. $0 criticizing Bernie Sanders on TV. That he's done some digital ads and written some op-eds.
Okay, he's got one up that's kind of hitting him.
You don't. You live in. Is he up in Wisconsin on TV?
Oh, he's all over.
Yeah,
the place
you see
Wisconsin.
It. Have you seen any anti-Bernie ads?
No,
haven't. No. And so. You know, wasn't the whole point of his campaign, wasn't the whole theory of the case that if the other candidates looked weak, that he would be the savior from Bernie? He's doing the opposite. He's paving the road for Bernie right now. He froze, I think, a lot of the potential support that Pete could have gotten coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire, because people who I think naturally would have gone to the Bernie alternative who was doing the best didn't, because they saw Bloomberg was waiting out there. He froze, I think, a lot of the support now that's thawing because of his poor debate performances that would have gone to Biden ahead of South Carolina. I think luckily Biden had a good debate this week and seems to be coalescing support back ahead for South Carolina. But to me, Michael Bloomberg's stated proposition for being in this campaign is protecting us from a Bernie Trump choice. And instead, he spent $500 million of his own money in order to potentially give us Bernie and Trump. And you know, the last part of my rant is, I just don't see how you can look at what has happened in our politics the last 5 years. Look, we've all been wrong about things. We've all had to open our eyes. I don't know how you can look at politics and see the populist revolution that has happened, that is about to overthrow both parties, and the anger at the elites, and say to yourself, you know what the people are clamoring for right now is a New York billionaire to spend $1 billion of his own money to tell them that they can't drink the soda that they like and have the, you know, guns that they like, and that he's not going to do anything to corral the banks and the elites. I just don't see how you can. So even if I did agree with him on everything, just the presumption of that and the potential negative consequences, it just has me riled up. And it was one thing a couple weeks ago where it might have made sense, but as we sit here today with Joe Biden leading in the polls in South Carolina and needing to coalesce support for Super Tuesday, Mike Bloomberg needs to be spending his money attacking Bernie Sanders, or he needs to turn that into a Joe Biden super PAC. Because as it is right now, if he doesn't do one of those two things, he's putting Sanders and Trump on a silver platter. And I don't think enough people are out there acknowledging that, because, you know, they want him to donate to their group next year.
I had Joe Lockhart on yesterday's podcast, and he made the same point, Tim Miller.
Joe Lockhart's a smart man.
Yeah.
No bucks for you.
No bucks for me. I am putting a cap on my future earning potential for the various Bloomberg charities.
The best thing about the Bloomberg campaign, though, is Tim O'Brien, who's got to be the best surrogate. they put him out. And he's got some good memes out there. The guy that has me riled up is Tom Steyer, though, because I have no idea what the rationale for his candidacy is.
You just hate his ties.
Pretty much everything. Like, make the list. The ties is part of it. But he has spent a lot of money in South Carolina. He's going to get a big chunk of the African-American vote, which comes right out of Joe Biden. And whether or not it's conscious. I mean, he is, whatever spoiler role Bloomberg is playing, Steyer is playing at times 10 with, you know, none of the charm and charisma that
I loved Steyer's answer to the what was the final stupid question of the CBS debate? What is the one thing that people misunderstand about you? And he's like, I'm not defined by my money. It's like, groan. It's like, all right, bad. Man.
At least he tells good jokes.
Steyer?
No. Steyer's back to Bloomberg.
Okay, so tell me more.
Oh, Steyer said I'm not different.
Sarah, tell me more about these focus groups. You actually talk to these people in the wild. I mean, you've actually...
The wilds of central Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And Arizona and Colorado and other places. I mean, I don't know what specifically exactly, but I'll tell you, one of the main things I've been trying to understand, and really it started a couple of years ago, back when I was just trying to figure out, you know, you remember this, when all of us were kind of bewildered, sitting around saying, well, what happened? What's going on with the party? And I was kind of like, well, we should go ask people what they're thinking and try to figure it out.
Radical.
I sit behind a wall of glass. Yeah. So I'm like, although I did, I got so upset at one of the more recent ones that I went in and sat down with this group of women. And the thing is, so central Pennsylvania is where I'm from. And so I always feel like I kind of like know these people in my bones. Like I really understand. And one of the things that I hear that I have a lot of sympathy for that maybe you guys will as well, is there's a real sense from, these are Trump voters, but many of them who rate him kind of somewhat bad or very bad or somewhat good. They're sort of just, we do variations of how on the fence they are about Trump. But one of the things that they always say is that one of the reasons that they voted for Trump is that they were so tired of sort of everybody talking down to them, you know, treating them like they're stupid or that they're racist for wanting border security. And I think that it's something that people don't quite understand about how Trump has been able to make himself almost like a partner with them, that he makes them feel like he's there fighting for a culture that they think they're losing. You know, immigration is the number one issue that people bring up, and oftentimes I am more sympathetic
in central Pennsylvania
and Ohio. And this is a total thing, which is the less direct interaction they have with immigrants, the more people bring up immigration.
Okay, so then what is it really about? If it's not about the real immigrants and the real economic impact, because in Wisconsin, before Trump, immigration was never a big issue. In fact, if you talk to dairy farmers in Wisconsin, they will tell you they can't milk the cows if they didn't have illegal immigrants. So it was not a big issue. So is that a stand-in for something else?
Yeah, well, there's a temptation there's a temptation to always write these people off and say, like, a lot of racism in the room.
Okay.
And there's definitely some of that. Mm-hmm. I remember somebody saying once, somebody told a story about her friend that she knew who was being deported and what a good American he was and how much he wanted to be in the country. And the women were shaking their heads sympathetically, and one said, for the 99 bad ones, there's always one good one, and that's too bad. And I was sort of like, you want to reverse those numbers maybe or something? But
conservative media has a lot of responsibility for this. Yeah. I mean, the immigrant crime coverage in conservative media is way disproportionate to, you know,
the actual
level of crime, criming that's happening. And so, I mean, I think that's some of it, if not all.
But the thing that I hear the most often is actually there's a broad-based support for having a welcoming attitude toward immigrants. There is a broad-based suggestion that actually immigrants are additive and positive. Lots of people tell their own immigrant stories about their grandparents coming from Italy or whatever it is. I think something that we have to grapple with who sort of don't understand why people are there for the build the wall thing is the sense of injustice that people feel around people just not following the law. And the sense that elites,
play by the rules.
The elites and politicians simply try to say like, well, we just don't care about enforcing the laws. We're not doing anything about it. And I think, you know, for people like us who might be more sympathetic to the sort of pro-immigration stance, I certainly am. I do think that that the Democrats are doing everything wrong on this issue, to say like, oh yeah, no, let's give health care to everybody, as opposed to
Can I just chime in on this Bernie point really quick?
That, by the way, is a headshot. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because you listed Charlie earlier, like here are all the issues where Bernie is going to have trouble, and you listed, and you didn't mention this one. It's going to be the worst.
Right.
And I freely admit it. I'm a liberal. I'm a rhino. Immigration is probably my most liberal issue, and so even I though I'm sitting there when Bernie's like, we are going to not only decriminalize the border, but then everybody that comes in, we're gonna has the same rights to all of the services and all the healthcare services that Americans.
That is the headshot.
That is a 10%, 5% issue. That is even in the Hispanic community that issue is underwater big time. You know, it's just crazy to me where they have somebody like Trump, you know, who is giving them on a silver platter 90-10 issues like Dreamers and, you know, deportations of kids that were, you know, born, you know, that came here when they were two.
It's mind-boggling. You are absolutely right. And the, you know, part of the Sanders theory is that, like, for example, in northern Wisconsin, where you have many, many counties that voted twice for Barack Obama and then voted for Trump, that these, you know, rural, non-college educated voters are going to come back to Bernie Sanders, that they're going to like his anti. No, that one issue, you go into any bar, you go to any Lions Club, you go to any, you know, church picnic in northern, western Wisconsin, which has flipped so dramatically, and you say, you know, the Democrats are going to make you pay taxes to provide free health care for illegal immigrants. You work hard for that. That will kill them, along with things like gun control and a variety of other things. But, you know, your point, Sarah, though, and then this cannot be overstated, that sense that people feel they're talked down to, that they are not respected, that they are treated with disdain, that those people hate us. And quite frankly, you know, you're sitting in the Midwest, and what do you see? You see Hollywood elites, you know, sneering at you. You see the media elites trying to figure out who are you. And it's very easy for someone like a Donald Trump to say, they don't hate me, they hate you.
That's right.
Exactly right. When they attack me, they're really attacking you because they look down on you and they think you are racist. So we think about, well, are people willing to accept racism? Well, part of the problem is, let's be honest about it, you have been demeaning these people for, and maybe there's some validity to it, but at this point it's like, I'm not even listening to you because you hate me, you look down on me, you despise me, you think I'm a bigot, you think I'm a racist, you called me a racist when I want to send my kids to a school of my choice, you say that I'm a racist when I want lower property taxes, you say I'm a racist, you know, and then we have to listen to you talk about which pronouns you're going to use, which is a signal that you have no idea the life that I'm living here, and please do not talk to me again about white privilege when my town has been decimated and wiped out and we have all this American carnage. And I do think that folks,
you know,
on
who
the
doesn't
left,
channel any of those things you just described, you know, who doesn't look down on people or doesn't even know what the new woke terms are? Uncle Joseph Robinette Biden, Scranton Joe.
See, I actually think that's true.
I do think it's true.
Did you see that video from him in South Carolina?
About his son.
About his faith he's talking about.
Yeah, his faith.
There's something. Look, Joe's got a lot of problems. Joe is a very, very flawed candidate. And I'm still trying to figure out, you know, how much of Joe is really all there. But he's got that compassion gene that is not a given. I mean, there's something about this guy that he can relate. So when I was doing you go into the George Webb restaurants, the bars, the church picnics, I could see Joe Biden working that group in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, La Crosse, Wisconsin, you know, Shawano, and people going, okay, this is he's like one of us. He doesn't think we're a bunch of redneck rubes.
I think that's really true. I watched that video, totally got chills from it, and I thought about, you know, he's a product of a different era, which is part of his problem. But one of the things is, like, you know, I can sort of identify with Pete on being sort of like a young gay person who was like a college educated, whatever, and I can identify with Amy or with Elizabeth Warren on when they talk about being women or whatever. But I can identify with Joe as a human. Like, that guy knows how to talk in a way when you say, I believe that deep down at your core, you are a decent person who loves this country.
Right.
And I swear to God, like, that's all I want. It's like all I want right now. Like, you know, we can take our conversations about principled conservatism, and I'm ready to put that aside for like a coalition of the decent, where we are not talking about things ideologically, and we are talking about, like, can we get back to a place where we are not, even though, you know, he has his moments, you know, hey, look fat or whatever it is when he starts mixing it up with somebody.
Yeah.
But like,
I don't think he was calling the guy fat.
I don't think so either. I don't think so either. I think he just misspoke in that instance. But it's still, I think what he is like a decent person trying to do decent things.
Yeah, and even though we may disagree with him, I mean, I have a different policy on this and that. He and I are going to be different on spending, on taxes and all that. But you know what? I'm willing to put that aside as long as we have that assumption of goodwill.
Yeah.
You know, I think, Sarah, you and I first met at a conference that was put together. Was like center-right, center-left folks. It was put together after the election, part of this process of what the hell just happened to us. And I don't know whether you had the same experience, but it was the first time in about 20 years that I sat down with people from across the political divide, and we had this respectful conversation in which we both were trying to figure out what the right answer was. Because up until then, it had always been, you know, you're an ignorant bigot, right winger, and everything. And unfortunately, I think with the rise of Bernie Sanders, we're kind of going back to that. And that little moment, that little taste of being able to talk with people as actual human beings, I mean, it was important to me, and I'd like to get it back. But I kind of feel it's kind of at risk.
Maybe. I don't know. I actually wonder if there's not a different opportunity, actually. And it's the inverse of that, which is that I think for the left, they sort of got to play the adults in the room for the last few years, while Donald Trump has just been running around like a toddler lighting things on fire. And now they're going to have to grapple with the fact that the thing that hijacked the Republican Party, the populism, the anti-establishment, like, they're going to have to grapple with that happening to their own party. They narrowly escaped it last time, and everybody sort of was able to just kind of put it in a box and be like, that's not who we are. We're the big kids. And I think even if it's not just Bernie, I think watching this field, which, let's just be frank, like, to go against the most, you know, the worst president in our lifetime, they didn't pick a hell of a field. Like, ultimately, their weaknesses were paramount.
So, Tim, what will happen to the Democratic Party if they lose the election to Donald Trump? I'm trying to imagine what the psychological... I mean, it was bad enough losing the first time around, but losing this
one. This is all, you know, sort of the three steps game theory. You never know. In some ways, I wonder if, you know, the best thing that could happen to the Democratic Party would be to nominate Bernie and have him get killed, because maybe it would sort of stamp out the, you know, idea that this would work again for another, I guess, how many years has it been since McGovern?
That's 40 years. The Federalist is making that argument and endorsing Bernie Sanders.
Oh, Lord. Okay. No. Well, I'm going to have second thoughts about that, that opinion then. But, you know, it could go the other way, too. And I think that's a major danger for, like, a Biden nomination. If Biden was not to win against Trump, I mean, that would basically sort of just hand the keys over to AOC at that point.
This is such an important point.
You might as well just shut down the fight.
And the reason that it's such an important point is that the thing that the Democrats have sort of walked themselves into here is not just the chance that, like, it could, now there's a better than 50% chance it's Bernie, but now also if Joe Biden pulls out a comeback kid, you now have the whole Bernie Sanders wing of the party ready to basically sit it out on his behalf, which you know.
I have zero. I was listening to a podcast with Cory Booker's campaign manager, Adisu, who's a fellow Oaklandite, and you know, he made this point in 2016. Bernie's unity speech at the Hillary convention left a little bit to be desired as far as convincingness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he always looks pretty grumpy, but he looked pretty grumpy. And so that is another, you know, to your point, if that is to happen, and there are all these people who instinctually will want to sit it out as kind of a pound
sand. Or vote
for
Trump.
Or vote for, you know, some insane Jill Stein type. Is Bernie capable of the unity and of fostering unity? It's kind of hard to imagine, and it's a sort of depressing but a little macabre, you know, kind of conversation that is happening that you see on Twitter online right now, which is anytime Bernie starts to gain momentum, all the Bernie people look at us and they're like, if this is so bad, aren't you going to get on board with Bernie? And then as soon as Bernie starts to lose, you know, it's like everybody's looking at the Bernie people and being like, are you going to put your money where your mouth is? And it seems tenuous on both sides at this point.
Well, I have a rooting interest in the Milwaukee convention being interesting because I'm from Milwaukee, the Milwaukee area.
Are you hosting like a kind of a Bulwark sleepover?
At
the convention week?
I should sign up with Airbnb or something because we do not have enough hotel rooms. I mean, you know, that's, but the question of, so what would happen if you had and I was talking with Joe Lockhart about this, a guy met me at the airport and said, they got to stop using the term brokered convention. They have to start describing it as a consensus convention that, really, if there was drama, the way you
don't
like
think
that.
I love Joe. I don't think you're tricking any of the Bernie
yeah,
bros.
That's right. I think. Oh, did you change the name? Oh my goodness!
But think about the convention.
Mastery of communication.
But think about a convention that is open, an open convention. The media attention to that, the drama, and whether or not there might be a boost to whoever comes out at the other end of that as opposed to the infomercial.
These people are so mean, Charlie.
Oh, yeah. Well, screw them.
Like,
but I mean,
there is not going to be a boost if there is a consensus.
You just think the Bernie bros are going to burn.
Lollipop convention.
They're going to burn Milwaukee down one way or another.
I have to tell you, I thought that the meanest people to be on Twitter was when I started working for Jeb and there was like kind of a gay left that said I was a traitor and they were really mean. And then I went against Trump, and then I had the Trumpers sending me draft threats, and I thought they were the meanest people. And now that I've been, you know, trying to argue for the Democrats not going down the same path and supporting Bernie, I think the Bernie people are the meanest. So there's always, you know, you can always get lower.
It is fun though.
I don't see any of those people enjoying a consensus convention.
So you and I are in exactly the same position in social media, where about half of the hate mail we get is from the Bernie folks, and then half is from the Trump folks. You know,
nicer to Bernie than you, by the way. You never Bernied. I haven't even done that, and they're still mean to me. So there's nothing except full submission they accept.
Well, you know, part of it is, of course, there's the part of the Trumpian right who says, you know, well, you guys are going to vote for Bernie, you know, so much for conserving conservatism. So I wanted to lay down the marker that I'm sorry. I'm used to being out on an island or an iceberg or whatever, you know. So I'm more comfortable there as an only child and all of those things. So if everybody, you know, if we meet in a phone booth a couple of years from now, which could happen.
Yeah, which is why I think, like, I don't want to jump the gun on having to, like, live in a binary world. Like, right now, we still live in a universe where anything is possible. Joe Biden could pull it out, you know, Mike Bloomberg could get religion. Pete and Amy could see that, like, there ain't a path, and there could be some consolidation. So, like, I'm saying there's a chance. And I'm going to live in that space. Before I start hashtagging my next step.
Okay, yeah. So, Tim, you've been saying, look, you have to make your move now. Bloomberg's going to have to dump the money on Bernie between now and next Tuesday. At what point does Pete and Amy need to get out of the race? Pete, Amy, Tom.
I don't see any path for Amy. I think she should already be out. There's an argument.
I
don't understand I'm pretty deep in the delegate math, but it's very complicated in the Democratic side with the 15% threshold. And I've seen some smart people argue that there actually is value in Amy staying in for Minnesota and winning it, mm-hmm. and that winning and keeping Bernie from getting those delegates is worth more than the
what
however
she's peeling
many,
from
whatever
Biden.
She's peeling. I've heard that. So I'm going to leave open that, you know, give the benefit of the doubt
this
that they've done
the
math. This
would be John Kasich winning in Ohio strategy.
Yeah, I instinctually think that's wrong and she should get out, but it's possible that the math works on that. You know, Pete, I think Pete deserves to have a chance to compete on Saturday in South Carolina. I mean, he's finished
right, but after
in the
that.
Top two, but, I'm skeptical of his, you know, going into districts and picking off.
Is anybody going to quit? Strategy. Is anybody going to drop out between Saturday and Tuesday?
One of them should. Biden need look. And Steyer. I wrote about this in the article about the lessons learned. Steyer absolutely yeah. should. Or how about an endorsement? I mean, where is, you know, a Bill Clinton or somebody just to carry a news cycle for Biden would be nice.
Nobody
whether
wants
that's
to hear
Amy
from Bill Clinton.
Or Pete or any who. Okay, fine. I guess Obama's not going to do it. No. Maybe Michelle's brother. Can we have like a lesser Obama endorse Biden? Pelosi. What about Pelosi? But this the race is going to California on Tuesday. Where is Nancy Pelosi? Is just ready to hand over the party to Bernie Sanders. I that doesn't make any sense to me. The race is going to her state on Tuesday. Why wouldn't she come out? That has to be helpful, at least with a certain.
It doesn't make sense to you, though.
California?
I mean, we watch. This is what we watched Republicans do,
no,
right?
It makes sense that it's happening. I'm like, ah!
Yeah, it's ugly game theory. I don't know, and I asked Joe Lockhart this question about whether or not Biden can do the comeback kid sort of thing, and of course the media narratives can switch so quickly, but still having the PTSD of what happened in Wisconsin, and by the way, I get emails like, don't use that phrase. Come on, yeah. What happened in Wisconsin, where I really, honestly, really sincerely thought that Wisconsin was going to be a turning point when Trump held them off, man. I mean, I really thought it was going to be the beginning of the turning point. It turned out to be this minor speed bump. So
it was our big moment, Charlie.
I know it was the best night
of the last half decade for us.
I've been dining out on that for 4 years now. So, but whether South Carolina, so let's say that Biden does win big, is it certainly possible? I mean, he's had some great news cycles. Does it change it, or does it just change it for 48 hours?
Is 3 days away, and, yeah. and then it could be, you know, it could go south, as I wrote in the Bulwark. But if he wins Texas, yeah, Texas is really an important state.
Because
that happens 3 days later. It's certainly no gimme. A big Hispanic population there. Bernie ran up the score with the Latino vote in Nevada. But California, remember, they take a month to count. Mm-hmm. Everybody complained about Iowa and Nevada, but California has a rule where you can mail in your ballot on election day. So they can't even count all the ballots till all the mail comes in for people who postmarked
it.
It
certainly dilutes
day.
the
right.
impact.
Right. So that is good news for Biden. So I think that conceivably, if he's able to win Texas and win some of these other states on Tuesday, it would be a much better situation than just the one-off, you know, kind of Wisconsin example that you gave. Now, if it goes the other way, it could very much be like Wisconsin, where if Bernie's winning, you know, most of the states on Super Tuesday.
And that Texas point is just that's like a place where you can really see Bloomberg being a problem because, you know, they're neck and neck. They're basically tied, Bernie and Biden.
Did you see the poll?
Yeah.
Yeah, where they tested the both? They tested
Bloomberg took Bloomberg out.
Seven, and then it's tied.
Yeah, that's right.
He took 7 points off Biden.
Yeah.
7 points. Well.
Yeah, get dark.
Where's the
whiskey,
it's the margin
Charlie?
Of our democracy.
Okay, I was going to try to like end this on a positive note. So by the time people listen to this, we may have hashed all this out at this summit meeting on the future of principled conservatism. And so, you know, check back with us next week and we'll have this. Oh, by the way, so what time is it right here? I actually have some news for you guys here because the poll in Wisconsin the Marquette poll should have just come out within the last hour. Am I right about that? So,
Looking that up, I'll make a plug for just after our podcast is finished. Beg to Differ will be coming in to do their podcast. We should do a crossover episode at some point with the Beg to Differ team.
Do they have a special guest this week?
I don't know. I see Bill Galston and Linda and Mona
there. I listened to the Yuval episode on my red eye here.
Yeah?
I did doze a little bit of the way through, but that had nothing to do with Yuval. It was making very interesting points, but it was a red eye. Yeah. I needed to get rest.
Okay, so all of the head-to-head matchups in Wisconsin are within the margin of error. Okay, so Klobuchar 46 to 46. Sanders 48%, Trump 46%, Warren 44%, Trump 47%, Biden 46-46, Bloomberg 44-45. These are within the margin of error. So,
you think that last poll was an outlier poll that had Trump up so much?
There was no question that that last poll was the outlier poll. This poll is, but again, what a shock. Turns out that Wisconsin is going to be a battleground state. Tim Miller, Sarah Longwell, thank you so much for coming in for this special weekend Future of Conservatism podcast.
Thanks, Charlie.
See you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.